to be looking at the question of the minimum wage and to think about how and in what way do our sources from our tradition have anything to say about this rather complicated debate. Actually, I had a Shabbat lunch yesterday with a friend of mine from college who has a PhD in economics now, and I was asking him, so what do you think about the minimum wage? And about 2 hours later, we're on the other side of that conversation. So I sort of appreciate the complexity of the issue and do want to spend a little bit of time sort of thinking through that, both generally and then also through the lens of some of the Jewish texts that we're going to look at as we explore this question. But just a brief sort of word of introduction about the generally related to minimum wage and also how it relates to some Jewish communities that may sound familiar to you. I was surprised to learn that actually the legal history around the minimum wage starts not with a minimum wage, but with a maximum wage. Apparently, after the Black Plague in England, the price in order to hire low-wage workers was so high because there were so few of them. In other words, so the supply and demand curve went completely out of whack because there were so few people who were able to step in and do these jobs that there was a bidding war around what it meant to pay for these people to work. And as a result, the King of England had to introduce legislation that capped the wage for day laborers, basically. And as a result of that, was the first sort of legal interference with controlling wages that, at least in the Western world, that I could find. And it, sort of what happened legislatively from there was that once you had a maximum wage, there was also some pull to drive towards a minimum wage, although that actually didn't get established legally until about 250 years later. In the first decade of the 1600s, there was legislation also in England that was passed to actually provide for a minimum wage. Eventually, these laws actually either were officially repealed or went out of use. And in the modern Western world, the minimum wage comes back only in sort of the progressive era in the end of the 19th century. Actually, I think New Zealand is the first country in the mid-1890s that passes a minimum wage law. And in America, everyone remember when in America we have our first minimum wage law? You remember, as I do, the New Deal and FDR. It was all part of that, the Fair Labor Act that comes out in 1938. And the minimum wage both set a price, so it was 25 cents an hour, was the original minimum wage, which in today's dollars would be $18, the experts. And also set a maximum number of hours that you could force people to work on an hourly wage, which was 44 hours a week. So you have both of those laws that were passed and was extremely controversial at the time, barely made it through Congress, but did, and again was following this trend that started in Western Europe of minimum wage laws that starts to pass in the early, in the mid 1890s. In this country now, there's obviously debate about minimum wage in New York, which is at the leading edge of the minimum wage debate. It's now scheduled by 2018 to have the minimum wage as $15 an hour, which would be the leading price in America. Some other places, California also has a similar law that's going to take effect, but later down the line, I think in 2022. These are all sort of being phased in. The federal minimum wage remains in the low, I think $7.15, low $7, although there's obviously some national push to push the price up to $15 or some place in between. Most states, if you look at the charts, most states, there are some states that hold to the minimum federal standard, but most states are somewhere above that. But again, New York and California are sort of at the leading edge of hitting $15. This is sort of where we stand as a country, and obviously this always comes up in the political debates as well in this presidential election. In the Jewish community, what's fascinating about the minimum wage debate is that there is some legislation that has been passed in some of the movements. The first one that I'll mention is that this is a great collection of reform responses from the reform movement, where they take questions. There was a question that was asked to the reform sort of body of law about whether or not synagogues have to hire union labor in order to construct a renovation. And in the question, they detail out that if you go with the union prices, it's going to cost them an extra $300,000. So the question is asked, and this is in the early 2000s, and the response that comes from the group in the sort of central reform movement, it basically says it's preferable to higher union wages. Meaning they give a whole bunch of arguments about why union wages are preferred, but they do not require you to do it. And so they sort of say, we understand that it's hard for you to raise an extra $300,000. We're not standing in your shoes and you have to do all that work. But here are all the reasons why, sort of morally and ethically, you'd want to pay that price. So that was the first thing that comes out in the Jewish community around this. And around the same time, in the conservative movement, Rabbi Jill Jacobs, who is a friend and colleague, and Rav Shai interviewed her just a few months ago here at Hadar, and she really is a leading voice in applying Jewish wisdom and law to sort of real-life practical issues that are emerging. So she brought a proposal in front of the conservative Jewish law committee that proposed requiring synagogues to pay the minimum wage, or frankly a living wage, which is a related but different concept. You know, how much money do you need to make in order to have proper food, shelter, and health care? That would require synagogues to pay a living wage to all of their essentially hourly workers, the custodial staff, food service, etc., that they would hire either on a permanent basis or sort of an events-based basis. And she brought this before the committee in the early 2000s. I think she originally brought it in 2000. It went up for a vote around 2006. She wrote it when she was a student in 2002 and then worked it through the system. It got up for a vote in 2006 and was voted down. You know, in the conservative system, they only need 6 out of 25 members. You only need 6 votes to pass a law. She got 3. And the reason that she didn't get a quorum to pass her proposal is that her proposal was very strongly worded, and she said that she worded it as synagogues must pay a living wage, which would make it binding on synagogues that were sort of in that system. And there was a dissenting opinion that was so fascinating to me. It was a dissenting opinion that was authored not by a rabbi, but by a non-voting lay member who was a member of the business community, who essentially said minimum wage is destructive, and you can't force businesses to use this. I would love to be a fly on the wall, read the minutes about what was going on there. What happened was they rewrote the tshuva. Jill went back and changed one phrase, which instead of require, she wrote strive to. And once she had strive to, it passed by a massive majority. There was only one dissenting person, a few abstentions. And as a result, there is a position in the conservative movement that you must pay a living wage you should strive to pay a living wage if you're a synagogue employing day laborers. And I really should credit Jill, who's a friend of mine, with doing a lot of the work and the sources and some of the sources that we'll look at today. Really, I'm influenced deeply by her thinking. That's sort of just the background about both as a country where we are with the minimum wage and Jewishly, sort of what communities are grappling with here. What I would like to do with you to start off before we dive into some of the Jewish sources is really just to actually to get a little bit more into the issue itself. What I brought to you is just a single page here from a very long, authoritative Wikipedia article. I profess to be no expert, although I did take economics 101 in college. No expert here, but passing it out. One page from this Wikipedia article, which very long, which details a number of the studies that are related to the minimum wage, as well as sort of like the economic theory that stands behind it, but also the way in which the economic theory, when played out in real life, doesn't actually hold. And then the counter, explanation about why the economic theory doesn't hold. So all this is spelled out there in great detail, and I encourage you all to look at it. But what I wanted to look at with you just right now, to use our own reasonable heads, is they have this very nice chart of reasons for and reasons against the minimum wage. Now, I'm not going to read too much into the fact that the column on the reasons against the minimum wage is a good third longer than the column for reasons for the minimum wage. But I think sort of the reasons are there. And of course, I invite you to come up with some of your own reasons. But what I would like you to do is we're going to spend a few minutes in Chavruta. We're going to Chavruta this, okay? Let's say we're going to read out these bullet points here. And what I'm going to ask you to do is just from your own sense, from your own feeling, your own intuition, sort of what makes sense for you, what makes less sense for you, what sort of works for you, what doesn't work for you in these arguments. And here's the crux of the matter, to do some cross-discipline thinking. Do any of these arguments call to mind for you any sources of Jewish wisdom that you might apply? Okay, so this is not a pop quiz on your, you know, expertise in Jewish sources, but just, you know, sort of like concepts or phrases that come to mind as you're thinking about this. I would love to hear it almost as sort of like a group brainstorm about the ways in which Jewish wisdom relates to this. So what I'm going to ask you to do is, this is going to be an opportunity for us, since you need to have no back. Are there any economics PhDs here in the room? No? Okay, great. So we're all on the same level, more or less. And therefore, everybody could be, Shai, who does have a PhD in economics, is gracefully taking an exit. But I'm going to ask, since everybody's basically on the same level here, what I would like you to do is to find somebody that you have not learned with before, or that you do not know. If you're a fellow here in the summer, I'm going to ask you to learn not with another fellow, but with someone else who is here. And I'm going to invite you to stand up, move around, re-jigsaw yourself. And we're going to ask these two questions, okay? Okay, we're going to come back together here. I would be curious to hear from you either what struck you as something that made a lot of sense to you, and or what was surprising to you, or were there sort of arguments you hadn't heard before that might have swayed you in one direction or the other? But like, you know, sort of, what made intuitive sense to you? What sort of, you know, works from these set of arguments, or what swayed you in some other direction? Yeah.
So we were looking for the facts to support some of these.
They're buried in the footnotes, which I conveniently didn't print.
What your PhD in economics friend had to say about whether the minimum wage is good for the economy or not.
Right. Here's the al-regal al-chat version. Which also you can read about. There was a famous study that was done. It's like a big study in the world of economics. Apparently, at a particular moment in the early 90s, New Jersey and Pennsylvania had minimum wage levels that were basically the same. And then New Jersey ended up passing a law that raised the minimum wage by, I think it was around $1.90, some significant increase. And Pennsylvania had only marginal increase. So they're able to study basically the before and after effects of two states that are adjacent to each other and therefore sort of regionally, economically are in the same place. And what you would imagine that would happen is, if you're an economist, you're just doing supply and demand curves, that if the if one curve is lifted artificially, then either businesses would decide, either they would shut down because they couldn't afford it, or they would decide to hire fewer workers, and therefore unemployment would go up. What they discovered was unemployment actually went slightly down in New Jersey. So this was sort of like a big revolution in that the supply and demand curves didn't work, and when you raise the minimum wage, unemployment actually goes down a little bit. So then they sort of, then they have some of the rebuttals against that study about why that happened, and maybe it was only, they happened to be on a sweet spot in the curve where they could raise the money and the demand was somewhat inelastic, but if they get up to $15, let's say, you know, which is like doubling the minimum wage as opposed to just increasing it marginally, then you might see some negative economic effects that you wouldn't have seen if they did sort of a marginal increase there. Essentially my friend was saying is that you can't, what that study proved is that your textbook economics people who are opposed to minimum wage had to deal with reality. But then they sort of pedal back from that a little bit, which is to say, okay, but maybe there are certain reasons why in this instance, the textbook's charts didn't work, but they might work in other cases as well. So then they sort of go back to the theoretical there, because like all academics, you have to knock down the people who said whatever they said before you. So I think sort of where you end up with is it's complicated and not as simple as we know that if you increase money supply, you know, inflation goes this way, whatever it is, they can't make those same predictions around the minimum wage.
We were wondering when most of these were written, because it seemed to us that there was a big difference between a minimum wage and a living wage.
Ah, okay, yeah.
So the notion that you could, removes low-paying jobs, for example, we've circled, that these are low-paying jobs if they're paying $7 or $9 an hour. And also the notion that you could, that a minimum wage encouraged education, because if you're working for $9 an hour, you're going to have to work so many hours unless there's a maximum, or you're going to have to work two jobs, you're not going to have time to go to school. So those were some of the things that
There is this sort of tension about opposite intended effect. The intended effect obviously benefits society. I think everybody's fighting for society, to sort of make improvements. But you might have some situation where if you raise the minimum wage enough, then people will be able to survive on the bottom of the economic ladder without any ability or incentive to become educated and more skilled so that they can take a higher wage earning job. But what you're pointing out is, but that assumes that they have the ability to sort of take off and go to school in the first place, as opposed to sort of, it is essentially functioning as a safety net. That's the other, one of the arguments against is, if you want to use the minimum wage as a safety net, well, we have a mechanism for a safety net. That's called the government.
Yeah.
In other words, you could supplement the wages of the employers, but not out of the pocket of the employer. You could supplement the wages by giving, the earned income tax credit or any other way in which you could give back money to people who are low wage earners, but not at the expense of the small business, let's say. Yeah.
When we talked about, building a society, we didn't look at this point by point, but more on a more meta level. But the question is whether the idea is to grow the economy, if that's the important thing, or if building a stronger society is the most important goal, whether the economy is the servant of society or the be and all end of by itself. And that's what we really saw on a larger level, is the difference between the two columns. It's really a philosophical debate as opposed to, you're right, the economists can prove anything.
Right.
And that's sort of where the Jewish and the
traditional. Yeah, so did you make some connections there? Meaning, were there certain Jewish ideas that you were connecting either to building a society versus building the economy?
No, we didn't talk about
that. Okay, we'll get it. Yeah.
I think following on that, I think most, I'm not that well versed, but I think many of the verses, like if you look at things in Kiddushim about leaving the corners of your field, they're not referring to society, they're really referring to taking care of individuals. And the wage argument in this country is an economic, societal thing. We're looking at the entire country, not at individuals kind of one at a time. Here, it was the personal responsibility of every individual to take care of other individuals. It wasn't for the purpose of improving the entire society. It was just looking at making sure each individual was taken.
Uh-huh. And therefore, if you have sort of the individual focus, you might come out on a different end than you would if you were taking some larger society focus. Yeah.
So I mean that the responsibility is coming from individuals, but the focus is to all poor people. So it is about how to create a society where the poorest have something. Where the responsibility directly comes, and that makes sense if you have like an agricultural economy where people are farmers. But if it comes from where the minimum wage comes is from people paying taxes, it's kind of the same thing.
Yeah, it's interesting because in some ways the layup, the pale like in Shicha, the sort of the what you were citing in from the Torah, those are essentially taxes for the poor, right? That function, in addition to other systems of taxes, like you have to give a tithe to the poor as well. Interesting, the tithe for the poor, you know how often you pay the tithe for the poor? Maser Ani? Shows up in a 7-year cycle where the 7th year is nobody gets anything because it's Shemitah, nothing's growing, and nothing's being harvested actively. So out of the 6 years, you give Maser Ani, you tithe for the poor every 3rd and 6th year. So that is to say, what poor people get every year is what's left behind in the field. But the additional money that goes into the coffers, as it were, is an additional tax that only shows up every 3rd and 6th year. The intervening years, the tithe, you still have to tithe, but the tithe actually gets spent in Jerusalem. This might be the sort of society versus economy side, right? Years 3 and 6, you're taking care of the poor, but years 1, 2, 4, and 5, you're spending money in the Jerusalem economy. You can benefit from that money, but the people in Jerusalem are the ones who are taking in the cash. You're sort of spurring the economy that's local there. So in some ways, they're playing in the middle of the, how much of this is a straight-up tax, and how much of this is meant to be sort of support a particular industry or geography. You're right, yeah.
So we were talking about kind of two principles, and I'm not sure we've resolved how they interplay, but one was, as Paul pointed out, the Torah says we should pay just wages. And so that's a really important concept to think about. What is a just wage? And then there's the other notion that the way you help a person the best is to give them the ability to work. So the question is, what motivates people to work more? Is a minimum wage going to help that, or does it undermine it? And that's kind of the discussion that we were trying to start.
Okay, good. Now, interesting, the just wage, I don't think... the Torah is very clear about respecting workers, and what the sort of the main case in the Torah is not denying wages, right? If you take away the cloak of, you know, of the poor person, you know, because they're indebted to you, then what are they supposed to sleep? You know, you sort of can't deprive them of you know, of their basic human needs, which maybe you could correlate to, you know, sort of fundamentally a minimum wage or a living wage. But Torah doesn't say, and you must make this amount. Even as we'll see, the sort of idea of setting a sort of either a poverty line or a wage a wage floor doesn't show up that often in Jewish sources. And we'll look at a couple examples where it does peek through. But I think those tensions, that, as you say, right, what's going to spur the person, the sort of the Rambam's hierarchy of tzedakah, where the highest level is, by the way, it's not just giving them a job, but also, you know, the highest level is, in addition to giving them a job, Rambam bundles this together. It's a job or a loan, right? Or even more radically, it's you go into business partnership with them, right? Here's, you know, you think you're like an excellent philanthropist, try this for philanthropy. Go into business with the person you would otherwise cut a check to, right? Because the idea is, otherwise, how else are you going to get them out of the sort of the cycle of poverty there? You can give them a certain amount any day, but if you can't get them to actually, but how are they going to do that? So you would be their business partner. So in some ways, there is this ideal of we're going to lift people out of the whole bottom wage earner game in the first place by raising them up and standing them up on their employment feet, as it were. A couple more, yeah.
It sounds to me as if... all of the details that we are pulling out in our classical sources about how to implement these policies in a way that protects people compares interestingly to the difference you pointed out in the Wikipedia portion. How long the negative list is versus how short the positive list is. Both of them sound like they're pointing to a really strong moral impulse in most people to say, of course we need a minimum wage, of course we do, of course we do, of course we do. And that the Torah's response to that is to say, how? And the Wikipedia, at least what's expressed in the Wikipedia article, is to say, well, wait, slow down, maybe we shouldn't. I think that's important.
Right, you're getting a little bit of, again, assuming everybody's on, you know, it's not like there's good guys and there's bad guys, and the good guys are for the minimum wage. There's some sort of complexity that, you know, that's added here, even if we're all trying to get to the other side, although maybe, Anne, the way you framed it, what's the base here between those two columns? Yeah, you're going to add.
There was, when I was in Israel a couple of years ago, there was this movement to place a seal on restaurants that were giving minimum wage to, no, a living wage to their workers.
Right, the Tav Chevrati, right?
Yeah. Right, so. And then it came to New York, and then I don't see it anywhere. So that's my first comment. I was wondering if anybody knew if that's alive and well, or, I mean, in a living way, right, where we get our wholeness. And the other thing I wanted to know is, are the rabbis paying attention to this in Israel?
And currently. You're saying.
Absolutely.
Right.
We'll talk about it later.
Right. So I think that for me is a very, very big question about doing things in America and how we look at things and, you know, in terms of our relationship with Israel and Jerusalem and how workers are treated.
Yeah. By the way, you know how to say minimum wage in Hebrew? I just learned over this table.
Schar
minimum. Yes. Minimum. We thought it was English word, but it's actually Hebrew. Which, by the way, according to Orit, who worked at the minimum wage at some point, it's 25 shekels an hour, is that what you said, right? So, which is a little bit less. Again, apparently there are 90% of countries have a minimum wage, and it can be very complicated. Like in America, it's state by state, so you have multiple minimum wages. In India, apparently there are 1,200 minimum wages that are like throughout the country. But it doesn't surprise me that Israel has a minimum wage. But also, my understanding of the Tav Chevrati is that in Israel, actually, the ethical kashrut movement is taking on some, gaining some momentum. It also has to do with the way in which the kashrut standards of the rabbinate, chief rabbinate, are not necessarily correlated with
ethics. And
Emma Rafayim
is doing really well.
Yes. So, And here in America, I think to the extent that it's stalled, again, there was a group called Uri Tzedek that was offering those to local restaurants here and maybe outside of New York as well. And then the conservative movement had their Magen Tzedek initiative, which never actually got off the ground because they weren't able to, for a host of logistical reasons, including some kashrut monopoly stuff, they weren't able to put an additional kashrut sign on things that were kosher. But there is some sort of sense of, yes, you want in order for me to eat somewhere, which is, again, an arena in which a lot of the low wage earners are working in, you want to have some sense that there is some above and beyond instead of just hitting the floor here. Maybe what we'll do is we'll take a look at the way in which you asked about the rabbis themselves currently in Israel. How are they dealing with this? We'll see. Actually, one of the a lot of the writing about sort of modern writing about this question comes in the question of unions. We mentioned that the reform movement already passed this idea that you should strive to, you know, doesn't have to, but you know, ideally should use union labor. Previous to that, in the 20th century, most of the big poskim, including Obadiah Yosef and Tzitz Eliezer, Eliezer Waldenberg, and here in the States, Moshe Feinstein, were all asked about whether unions are permissible at all. Can people unionize? Or is that something that's against halakha? And they all came down, Uziel also was the Sephardi chief rabbi in Israel at the time, they all came down on the side of unions. They all said that it is halakhically permissible to unionize for the purpose of fighting for a fair wage. So whereas they didn't address the question of minimum wage directly, although I don't know how the legislation around in Israel currently, how they got to the minimum wage, if the rabbi has anything to say about that, but they were coming out in favor of unions. Let's take a look a little bit and see some of the sources that do touch on this, because again, as a concept, as an economic concept, it's something that happens way after the classical rabbinic period, but it's something that, that you can still derive stuff for. So if you're in the salmon-colored sheets here in this in the book, it's right after the green. And by the way, I'll just a guide to the book. There are some, like, here and there. There are just other commercials for other things that we're doing. So when you're spacing out, I invite you to feel free to flip through. So in the salmon-colored pages, let's just turn over to page 4. This gets, I think, something that Paul was talking about earlier. The question of a wage at all. Meaning, why pay someone a wage? You could imagine a scenario, and indeed it was brought up, why not just give them the stuff that falls out to the side, like in Peyon Shicha, the stuff that you can just grab from the field. Why do you have to have a wage at all? So you see here, in most of these laws come from Bava Metzia, which is again a commercial for our Nezikin Siyum. You will get to go through all of these laws if you are participating with us. But here we are in Mishnah Bava Metzia 10.5, so at the top of page 4. Does someone want to read, one who hires a worker? Go ahead, David, why don't you read it out loud, please.
One who hires a worker to work with him with straw or stubble, and he said to him, give me my wages, and he said to him, take what you did as your wages, they do not pay attention to him.
Okay, read the Tosefta, and the Mishnah and the Tosefta are parallel in terms of time, but the Tosefta is stuff that didn't make it into the canon. The Mishnah is the canon, Tosefta is sort of extra-canonical, but same ideas, yeah?
One who hires a worker to bring grapes, apples, or plums for a sick person, the person went and found that he is dead or healthy.
They say he's not sick anymore, so his job doesn't work, yeah?
He should not say to him, take what you have brought as your wages. Instead, he should certainly pay him his wages.
Okay, so what I take from these laws is that although you might be tempted as an employer to say, why don't you just take the stuff that you're working in, like have some grapes, okay? The grapes didn't get to the person who was sick, he's no longer alive, so I got these extra grapes. And instead of saying, just take the grapes yourself, which are of some value, you have to actually take the wage. Let's say the employer can't deny someone wages once promising them that they would be earning money as opposed to just take the sort of the goods that you were dealing with yourself. What do you think is the reason behind that? Or what might be the reasons that someone might demand? I mean, what's wrong with giving someone the grapes and, yeah?
People have their own priorities. They may not be eating grapes for the rest of the
day. right, exactly, right.
You can't pay your rent with grapes.
You can't pay your rent with grapes, right. Maybe you can if the landlord would also take the grapes. But right, it's sort of the idea of giving some autonomy, some agency to the person who's doing the work, it's not just the value. You could, you know, sort of, the grapes could be worth $10, but unless you give them the $10, you're denying them the opportunity to sort of drive some agency there. Could you think of another reason why, in other words, is there a possibility that the person is actually not trying to save money, that the employer's not trying to save money, but is actually trying to do some favor? What's the advantage of grapes over wages? Is there any advantage at all to the grapes or the apples or the plums?
He has plenty of them.
What's that?
The employer has plenty of
them. Okay, so it's certainly an advantage to the employer, but what about the employee, yeah?
I mean, I'm thinking maybe they don't have to pay Maser or some kind of tax themselves.
Ah, okay, maybe they don't have to, I'm not sure if they'd be able to get out of sort of the temple taxes, but maybe there's some economic, they got more grapes than they would have been able to buy with the wages that they would have gotten anyway.
Or they don't have to pay
tax break.
A tax break, right, you get some sort of tax benefit there? Yeah, okay. Any other thoughts? Yeah,
they don't have to go shopping?
Right, exactly, right? That is to say, depending how hungry you are, right? You might want to actually skip over. I mean, also, is the market even open at the end of the day? Like, you've been laboring all day long, and now your mission ended, and you find out you couldn't deliver the grapes, and so you're left with with the grapes here, and then you get money at the end of the day, but maybe you have to wait till the next day to spend it, but you're actually hungry right now. So depending on how hungry you are, depending how sort of bottom subsistence labor you're dealing with, there might be some advantage just having food. Now again, in the first case, straw or stubble isn't going to help you as much either, but at least for something that you could consume right away, you might say, oh yeah, there is some. And there are stories in the Talmud of sort of poor people who go from house to house, some of them getting money and some of them getting bread, and there seems to be some favoring of giving out of bread because it saves them the trip to the supermarket. They get to sort of feed themselves immediately. Yeah, you're gonna add.
There might be an option also for them to sell the grapes and make more money than they actually made getting the grapes.
Ah, good. Okay. Well, see, actually, the concept of actually putting your capital to use, meaning you're investing. You can either sort of sell at a higher price and therefore make a profit. Or, this gets back to Larry's idea. Well, if I take $10, well, maybe I actually don't need to spend it on, right away on the market because I have my pantry at home, but maybe I could invest the $10 and I'll be able to sort of, drive some profit in the longer term, which I wouldn't be able to do unless I had fluid capital, yeah?
I think about, the application today. You're walking down the street and you see someone who wants money and you think, well, I'm passing a bagel store. It's a little paternalistic. Are you going to spend it on alcohol, so I'll go in and buy you a bagel? But I'm deciding how you're spending the money, as opposed to giving you the freedom, and me being suspicious of you that you're going to use it poorly.
Right. Now, my economics professor would say, if you get it's the opportunity cost. If you give them the money for the, if you give them the bagel, uh-huh, then they don't have to spend their next dollar on the bagel, and they can spend their dollar on the wine.
Right.
So you shouldn't give money to poor people at all. That's what I learned in economics. But yes, right. In theory, right, you're being paternalistic with the eye towards sort of controlling the way in which the money is expended. You don't give, it's the opposite of wanting to give them agents. You actually don't trust them to make the right decisions. So you're going to sort of short circuit that. Yeah, you're going to.
In Israel, there's a fashion house for women called Comme il faut. Which is considered, for some reason, they sell themselves as feminist designers. And for a while, they were trying to make this website, and they wanted to attract women journalists to write and then get a jacket in return or something like that. And there's a group of female journalists who said, they would never suggest such a crazy idea to a male journalist. So the another side to it is that it's taking advantage of someone who could not really control the negotiation.
Ah, good. Okay, right. There's some power element here. And if the boss says, by the way, I want to get hired the next time I want to deliver the grapes. And so if the boss says, why don't you just take the grapes, I don't have the power. So the court has to step in, the legal system has to step in and say, you can't do that, as opposed to expecting the person to say, no, I don't want $10 worth of grapes, I just want $10. You can't actually trust them to be able to do that in the system that they're in. Yeah.
The other thing that seems to be happening here is simply keeping the agreement that you made with him in the morning. If in the morning you had said to him, pick these grapes for the sick man and keep 20%,
and he agreed, then you have an agreement. But the point is, you hired him and said, I'm going to pay you this amount of money, and maybe all day he's been picking those grapes, thinking, well, I'm going to be able to pay my kid's nursery school tuition. You can't back out of the... It's a
matter of changing the terms of the deal in some way.
Yeah,
right, okay.
This is more in terms
good.
Of contract.
Okay, so that brings us to our next, you want to add? Yeah, please.
I just want to say that all of these samples seem to set up an adversarial situation between employer and worker. You can't trust the employer is implicit in all of these discussions. And I don't necessarily want to accept that.
Okay. Great. Okay, so I think you're raising a wonderful question, which is, what is the deep motivation behind each of the characters here, and are they, in fact, sort of forever in loggerheads, or is there some sort of joint idea of course I'm going to be fair to you? And you're saying, you know, I think in some ways the law is set up to protect people against the cases in which, hopefully very few cases, but nevertheless, cases in which, employers and employees are at loggerheads, but you're sort of imagining a system, which I love to imagine as well, in which it doesn't have to be sort of this intense fight all the time. This is sort of like the base case as opposed to the ideal case. Let's look at sort of related to what you're saying, another example of the way in which, what is the relation between the employer and the employee, and what's assumed? What are the assumed terms when you set that contract at the beginning of the day? Remember, these are oftentimes day laborers. So what is the assumption? Turn over to page 2. We'll look at Mishnah in Bava Metzia, which is unusual on a number of fronts, including that it has a story. Most of the Mishnah is just straight up law without narrative. But here we have an interesting example of a narrative and a law that sort of cuts against the narrative as rooted. So on the bottom of page 2, one who hires workers. Does someone want to just read that out loud? Paul, go ahead.
One who hires workers instructs them to begin work early and to stay late. In a place in which it's not the custom to begin work early and to stay late, the employer may not force them to do so. In a place in which it is the custom to feed the workers, he must do so. In a place where it's the custom to distribute sweets, he must do so. Everything goes according to the custom of the land.
Okay, so the minhag ha-makom, right? This is the idea that minhag, whatever is the custom, the norm, that's what we have to follow. Okay, so this is the idea that there would be no federal minimum wage, right? This is sort of like each locality has its own set of rules and ideals, and that's what's going to happen there. And by the way, Yerushalmi has an example of, well, let's say you're in a place where you don't require people to start early and stay late, and could you go to another place where they do require people to start early and stay late, and go buy those workers, and then bring them back to your land where it's not the minhag? You know, could you cross state lines with certain things to the benefit of the employer? So they play out that case, and they actually come out on the side of the employee and say you actually can't do that unless you're in favor of the employee. In other words, you could go to the opposite. From a place where it is the custom to start early and stay late, you go to a place that is not the custom and preserve their custom, but you couldn't do the opposite. You couldn't make someone work longer than is their local custom. You're going to add, Andrew?
Well, I think you just answered my question, because I was thinking of the example, which is, if you're an employer, you go to a place where, in fact, the custom of the land is abusive, and you want to do better. So can you break the custom?
Yes, right, exactly. So in favor of the employee, you can. This is in Yerushalmi's playing out of this here. But what you have here, what's sort of very, very clear from this law is, whatever the custom, nobody says, you're not allowed to start early and work late. That is sort of unethical. No, there's some sort of laissez-faire economics. It's whatever the custom of the local place is, okay? Now we have a narrative that jumps in here, and we'll see what happens. We'll see what sort of assumptions are at play. So, Paul, keep going.
The story about Rabbi Yochanan ben Matya, who told his son, go, hire us workers.
Yeah, now Rabbi Yochanan ben Matya is a character who appears no other place in rabbinic literature. This is his one time that he appears, okay? So he has a son, and he says to the son, go hire us workers. Apparently, not just a lot of rabbis also had industry connections, both high and low-paying jobs. And he apparently, a lot of places in the Talmud, whenever you see a story where the father, typically the rabbi, says to his son, go do something, you know it's not going to work out well. Something's going to go wrong. You want to do something right, do it yourself, okay? That's the main idea. Okay, so let's see what happens. Go hire us some workers.
His son went and promised them food, without specifying what kind or how much. When he returned, his father said to him, "My son, even if you gave him a feast like that of King Solomon, you would have not fulfilled your obligation toward them, for they are the children of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. However, as they have not yet begun to work, go back and say to them that their employment is conditional on their not demanding more bread than vegetables."
More than bread and vegetables. In other words, right? What is the assumption here? If I say to you, without specifying, you know, included in your day labor, I'm going to give you lunch, right? What's the assumption here? I want lox and bagels, right? This is spoken like somebody who is not from New York, but lox and bagels is like the most amazing thing you could ever imagine, right? So, right? The idea is that, what's the feast of King Solomon? I just brought it to you so you could see, right, in the next source down. Right, I don't even know what these things are, right? But 10 fattened oxen, 20 pasture-fed oxen, 100 sheep and goats, deers, gazelles, roebuck, fatted geese. You're going to have an amazing meal, right? The idea is that in some way you would never ever, if you're the employee, you would never ever in your dreams expect this kind of treatment. But Rabbi Yochanan ben Matthiah claims that that is actually the assumption. That is to say, there is no upper limit on what the employee is meant to get. Why? What's the reason the employee gets such royal treatment, literally royal treatment? According to the Mishnah, why does he get it? Why not? Of course, he's going to get bread and vegetables. He's a day worker. He's not going to get fat and geese, right? Yeah, the children of Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. What is it? To me, that seems to say something of, when I'm the employer, and I'm looking at the employee, I see, taking the opposite view of your worldview, I see someone who is other than me. Right? The whole thing is that I'm the boss, and you are someone who is not the boss, and that's why I get to control what you earn, what you eat, all that stuff here. But Rabbi Yochanan ben Matthiah comes out the other end and says, no, in fact, the employer and the employee are the same. We are descended from the same people. And as a result, you have to assume that they get the highest level of whatever they're supposed to get, not the lowest level. That is to say, now, this is sort of benefits here. This is perks. This is what you get to eat while you're on the job. This is not about the wages. You do not have here. We'll see, there's only one tiny little moment when rabbinic literature tells us anything about minimum wage. But this is not minimum wage, but this sort of does underlie, I think, what are our assumptions around what it might mean to employ someone. The assumption is not, I get away with whatever I can. I give them the minimum. Rather, the assumption is, it's the maximum, right? The assumption is, they should get as much as is possible. Because after all, they are Bnei Avraham, Yitzhak, v'Yaakov, and as a result, they deserve that, right? It's a totally different orientation towards the labor as opposed to get away with whatever I can. Rabbi Yochanan ben Matthiah is your idea. He is living in a world in which he respects these people so much, he sees them so much himself in them, that he's unable to imagine a world in which you give them anything less than a feast, unless you specify. And then sort of just to control your costs, you have to specify what you're going to give them. Yeah. No, okay. Okay. So now, the mission doesn't end there. We have this story, but then we cut against the story. Go ahead.
Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel said, "It's not necessary to make such a stipulation. Everything goes according to the custom of the place."
Okay, so at the end of the Mishnah, you sort of pull back from this idea. If you just left off with the story, you'd have the sense of workers get sort of defaults to the maximum. But now we have Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says, no, everything is according to the custom. You know, yesterday when this guy got a job next door, he didn't get a feast like King Solomon. So it's whatever the custom of the place is. So of course there's some reasonable range of what it means to say I'm going to have lunch. And if you didn't specify, he can't expect anything more than the reasonable range. Right? So Rabbi Yochanan ben Matthiah ends up being an outlier who assumes that the person who is working for him is deserving much more. But sort of the story is preserved, even though halacha doesn't go that way, I think in a fascinating way, to sort of even just raise for us, in a way that I would never have considered, the possibility that somebody is operating under the assumption that the worker is meant to get everything possible that would ever be available to him, unless you specify otherwise. The default is the high, not the low. Yeah, Karen.
I read it differently.
Yeah.
I read it that even if you gave them a feast like that of King Solomon, you would not have fulfilled your obligation to them because you haven't paid them. In other words, working in this place is a salary plus a plus.
Oh, you're reading it sort of related to the other law.
Yeah.
Like you can't switch money for food.
Right. So,
In
other words, even if you give them the Feast of King Solomon, you haven't made up for the fact that you didn't pay them any wages.
Okay, that's fascinating. And then, so what do you make of the answer then when he says, okay, but they'll go back and stipulate with them that they shouldn't demand anything more than bread and vegetables? I mean, they should specify they actually want food as opposed to wages at all. The reason it seems to me like when you read the next sentence, that at least it seems like to me it's a perk, but I like your read as the possibility of, no, you can't change the terms of the deal, which is that they actually deserve, you would never be able to pay them enough food to actually get them what they want in money. And so you have to pay them the money originally. Yeah. Yeah. Technically, it sort of functions the same way. Minhaga Medina, Minhaga Makom. Minhaga Makom is less geographically based.
It sounds like Medina would be a state or
correct.
Law.
Correct. For them, Medina was less, I think, sort of state-run, because they weren't running the state themselves, but sort of functions as a sort of geographic area that might be slightly larger than Minhaga Makom.
I guess that begs the question, because we're talking about how does that get established? How does that minhag get established? And I can't help but read up this here. It says tradition is not just what we receive, it's also what we create. So, the point is that we're trying to say, well, what should the minhag makom be?
Good. Okay, right. Is there a sort of a base case zero when you're saying we are going to establish what the minhag makom is, and then it'll sort of set precedent going forward? But is there some way in which you could actually sort of have some influence over that minhag makom? Well, I want to look at one other sort of related to that question of how do you establish what the base case is and how that changes. Look at one other fascinating example, which I thought of when I thought about minimum wages, which is the question that we say it every morning in davening, the question of what things have no minimum. Ein lahem shi'ur. So if you turn back to page 1, this is in, again, we recite it in traditional davening when you're supposed to say a bit of Torah every day. So the way the Siddur is organized, they give you a Mishnah, they give you a selection of Torah, which is often Birkat Kohanim, the priestly blessing. They give you a Mishnah, and they give you a Gemara, a piece of Talmud that's commenting on the Mishnah, or expands on the Mishnah. So what do we say in the morning? Elu dvarim she'ein lahem shi'ur. These are things that have no measure. And when you sort of translate what does it mean to have no measure, you'll see that it could be either a minimum or a maximum. Let's sort of play it out. Ha'peah va'bikurim va'reayon. So each of these are technical things. Peah we already talked about that's the corner of your field. Bikurim is the first fruits to the temple. And then Reayon is being seen in the temple, and you're not supposed to be seen Reikan, not supposed to be seen empty-handed. Ukemilut Chesed, or in some texts, Kemilut Chasadim, Vitamud Torah. Okay? Now, oftentimes we assume there is no maximum, right? Vitamud Torah, there's no maximum to Torah study. Ein lahem shiur. You could study Torah forever. But actually, when you sort of read it in context, you see that what they're talking about, they may also be talking about a maximum, but they're also talking about a minimum. That is to say, there is an opinion in the Gemara that if you were to study one section of Torah for a year, right? One day of the year, you study one section of Torah, you have fulfilled your obligation to study Torah. Now, that actually doesn't get down in the majority, but there is an opinion that's put out that way. That is related to this idea of there's no minimum amount of Torah study. You don't have to hit a threshold of Torah study. Right, so actually, when I do that in the Siddur in the morning, I'm sort of playing this out. All I do is learn this Mishnah, and I've sort of checked off my Torah learning for the day. Right, but this also is the case of there is no minimum for Peah. Right, Peah, how big is the corner of the field? So it's like Torah study. I'm great, I'm busy person. I don't want a lot of Torah study as my minimum. But what about Peah? Right, so if there's no minimum for the corner of the field that you're supposed to leave. So it turns out that you can leave a very small portion of your field, a sort of, a minuscule portion of your field, right? It's not like you have to leave 10%. You can leave this tiny bit, right? This is like when I ask my kids for a little bit of the cookie that I bought for them, and they sort of begrudgingly split one of the sprinkles in three, okay? So that's like Elohim Shior, okay? There's no minimum. They have satisfied paying off their tax to me by a tiny little bit. So you could get away in a system where you have taxes, but the taxes are determined by whatever you think is the minimum. You've got to say, there is no minimum. You can just set the minimum, Ein lahem shi'ur. Okay, now what's amazing about, so this is about, so who establishes the minhag, okay? So the minhag here seems to be, that there is no minimum, right? Whatever you leave, that's what counts. But then, amazingly, the next Mishnah, okay? The next Mishnah says, Ein pochatin lepeah mishishim. You cannot actually do less than 1/60th for peah. Okay, so in Mishnah 1, they say, there's no minimum. In Mishnah 2, they say, by the way, there is a minimum. And it's 1/60th. By the way, the rabbis are counting, although we are sort of used to base 10, they're in base 12, right? That's why it's like 1/60th is, you know, the drop of milk in the pot. It's sort of the small, I mean, we do this also with minutes, obviously, it's also, you know, but you have, 1/60th is sort of a small, you know, it's a small portion, like sleep is 1/60th of death. It's a small amount, but it's not zero. You can't go less than 1/60th, okay? They entertained a moment, like for one Mishnah, where there was no minimum, and they sort of can't resist, and they say, but actually there is a minimum. And the Mishnah deals with it right here as well, and they say, V'afa pi shamru, ein lepeah shi'ur, even, and now you know that shi'ur means a minimum, because the Mishnah itself says, even though we just said a second ago that there's no minimum for peah, it's all according to the size of the field, according to the number of the poor people, and according to the amount of the crop. And they play that in the Gemara. They say, if you have a bumper crop this year, so yeah, you're not going to give the same amount of pay as you did last year. It's going to be adjustable rates, depending on how well you did. Okay? That is to say, they are setting some minimum. So you see, in sort of the base case, you have this old, old Mishnah, this sort of proto-Mishnah that says, there's no minimum for any of this stuff. And then they're not willing to stay there, and sort of even in the Mishnaic period themselves, they say, actually, there is a minimum, right? And they sort of play this out. Then they give you an example later on in the parak of a group that seems to be somewhere in the middle here. The people of Beit Nemer, Mishnah Peah 4-5, the people of Beit Nemer would gather fallen crops with rope and give peah from every row of the field. That is to say, instead of saying, I'm going to give you the corner here, right, which you would get only after the harvest is done. What they did is they would harvest with rope, and then it's Mara describes everything that would sort of fall within the boundary of the rope, they would get to keep it. Anything that fell out of the boundary of the rope was left over for the poor people, and therefore poor people could go while the harvest was going on, didn't have to wait till the end of the harvest and get whatever was left, whatever the owner decided was the corner, but they could sort of take it as the harvest was going on, therefore it came faster to them. That's one idea, okay? So they would gather with a rope, and they give peah from every row of the field, not just the corner. Now, when the Yerushalmi explains this, they say, in the bottom of page one, it's taught in a braita. Abba Shaul says, we talk about Beit Nemer, we have two traditions. One is lignai, and one is lishvach. One is for shame, for degradation, they say they did the wrong thing. One is for praise, they did the right thing. What's the thing for shame? They would only give 1/100th as their peah. That is to say, we just said in the Mishnah that the minimum is 1/60th. But Beit Nemer, what they would do is, they would give 1/100, right? So now, we mentioned them for praise, and that they would gather rope and give from pay up from each row. That's what I described. That's sort of in order to help the poor people. But in a world in which the Yerushalmi already says Beit Nemer had a different tradition. So now you have three traditions for pay up. A place that should have had no minimum, right? Pay up. There's no minimum to the corner I can leave. And now I have one tradition, which is 1/60th. I have another tradition of Beit Nemer, which maybe preceded this tradition of 1/100th. They're both minimums, it's just that this minimum is a little bit more, right? So you have this struggle where they're trying to figure out, and they say, no, there's no such thing as no minimum. You have to have a minimum. Now let's fight about what the minimum is, right? I think it's 1/100th, you think it's 1/60th, but nobody thinks anymore that it's zero. That's minuscule, that's a third of a sprinkle. Yeah.
So all these discussions about minimums are about quantity, and I think there's an issue of quality too, because if you're getting a payoff while the harvest is going on, the fruit is fresh, and if you're getting it at the end of the harvest, it's sitting over there in a pile, and the sun's shining on it, and it's all getting overripe.
Okay, good. So now you're sort of saying, what is the quality of the food that I'm giving over as opposed to the quantity of it? And could you play that out as well? Or is this only about crops that are damaged, you know, from being overripe?
I think any crop is going to be damaged. Even wheat, it's going to dry out. I mean, I don't...
So you're in the team that says Beit Nemer was lishva.
Yes.
That is to say, they were doing the right thing. They weren't establishing a sort of low minimum. They were doing something that was better for the person because they were able to take it faster, and therefore the quality of what they got was better. That's also obviously where money plays in differently. That's why the sort of fungibility of money is more preferable to the grapes that you didn't get to deliver to the sick person.
I think it's interesting that all of these discussions are dealing with percentages of the total, and our discussion of minimum wage is kind of a arbitrary setting that's not based on how much a company is earning. It's just based on what we think is a living wage. Here, it's really based on a percentage of what the farmer's producing.
Okay, good. So, with that, I want to read the last text that we're going to close with, because it actually gets to that tension as well. So if you look at page 5, just flip over to page 5, very short text, also from Bava Metzia, from Tosefta Bava Metzia, so it's the second one from the bottom. It starts with the ellipsis, the people of a town, B'nei Ha'ir, are allowed to stipulate on three things, market prices, on measures, and on the wages of workers, schar poali. This is the only place in British literature where you actually have an idea that there's somebody that sets wages that are not negotiated one-on-one with the employer, right? That there is somebody, B'nei Ha'ir, whoever they were, that were setting the wages. Now, whether this is a maximum wage, a minimum wage, we don't know, and we also don't know what's driving their calculations. We just have this one statement that apparently they had the power to do it. So this becomes the text that the modern post can use to support unions, where they say B'nei Ha'ir, it's already going back to the Rishonim, say B'nei Ha'ir could be people in a particular industry. So you can have people in a particular industry saying, here's what the minimum wage is for us, and they use that as the ability to say what a union is. But when you look at give me an example where they actually set a minimum wage. So the place that I found that starting off from Jill's sources, if you turn back to page 4, just see how this works. It's amazing. In the Gemara, the bottom of page 4, in the Gemara this is the only place where you have an actual price that's set as a minimum. It says, Rav Yehuda and Rav Yossi said, the setters of decrees in Jerusalem, some legal authority, some court, they would take their wages of 99 maneh from the gifts of the temple chamber. And if they were not satisfied, they increased it for them. And then the Gemara goes on the next page. If they were not satisfied, are we dealing with evil people? Rather, the text should read, if they were not sufficient for them, even if they objected, they increased it for them. That is to say, oh no, we don't want to be paid more, but I'm going to force you to take more because they were righteous people. Okay, but what you have here is a stipulated wage of 99. Right? They were taking that amount. Now, if you look what the Rambam does right above it, just back on the bottom of page 4, he says the correctors of books in Jerusalem would take their salaries from funds collected primarily to cover the cost of sacrifices. The judges who judge cases of theft in Jerusalem, that's what we just read, the setters of decrees, they would take their salary from these funds. And how much would they take? They would take 90 maneh per year. Now, there's a debate about whether the Rambam had a different version. Why isn't it 99? It's 90. Okay, get into that. But either way, he's setting a specific amount. And if that was not enough for them, then they would increase the amount. And even if those communal workers didn't want to take more, they would increase the amount according to the needs of their workers, their wives, and their families, right? So what you have here in this text is the first example of someone actually trying to settle down on there's a minimum wage. There's an amount that you're supposed to hit. But then immediately as they say that, they back away and they say, well, actually, that's adjustable based on the living wage, essentially what you need to support your family, right? And as a result, even though they stipulate the amount of money that you're supposed to get, you actually immediately back away from that and say, no, what really we want to drive in terms of setting minimums for people or the amounts for people is something that's going to actually translate into support for the people that they need to feed in the first place. So I think what I take away from all these sources in this investigation is that although Judaism has a lot to say about the rights of the workers and the way in which the employers and the employees are meant to be treating each other fairly, you go to all the thing about whether the employee can cheat on the employer, and the answer, short answer, is no. Okay, but you have here some little wading into the idea of where you might look to start to puzzle through the question of a minimum wage for our own time.